We are here this morning to interview Dr. Howard Wolpe, the Africa Project Director at the Woodrow Wilson School at the Smithsonian Institution. Dr. Wolpe was former member of Congress for seven terms, elected in 1979 to the U.S. Congress, and later became the chair of the House Africa Subcommittee. In addition to that, he was in his election to Congress, he was representing Battle Creek, Kalamazoo, and later the city of Lansing. He had a prior history in the Michigan House of Representatives and was a member of the Kalamazoo City Commission at one time. He's also a professor at Western Michigan University, and for a time at University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, and for a summer at Michigan State University. He's been a prolific speaker and author on Africa, including his book published by Michigan State University Press, Nigeria, Modernization and the Politics of Communalism, co-edited with Robert Melson, as well as other publications on the United States and Africa, A Post-Cold War Perspective, The Other Africa, An End to Afro-Pessimism, Urban Politics in Nigeria, and The Great Lakes Crisis, An American View, the topic on which he is working now in Burundi and Rwanda. He was the presidential special envoy to Africa's Great Lakes region under President Clinton, and has been a public spokesperson on African issues across the country since the 1980s. Howard Wolpe has his BA degree from Reed College, and his PhD from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, where he worked on politics in Nigeria. We want this morning to ask Dr. Wolpe something about his personal history and about his work with Africa, with Nigeria in particular, and with Africa in the Congress. As Congressman, Howard Wolpe represented an extraordinary moment in American history where he succeeded the work, first of all, of G. Menon Williams, former governor of Michigan and Chief Justice of the Michigan Supreme Court, who also was in the Kennedy administration the first ever Assistant Secretary of State for Africa. It was G. Menon Williams that put the United States publicly on the side of African independence and development in that position. He was followed by the work of Congressman Charles Diggs from Detroit, who was the first chair of the House Africa Subcommittee in the U.S. Congress, and who helped to put Africa on the map there and put Africa, the United States, on the side of African independence and democracy in Southern Africa as well. And then Congressman Wolpe becomes very quickly the chair of the House Africa Subcommittee. And in that position, working with the Congressional Black Caucus and the anti-apartheid movement in the United States, brokers the coming of the Comprehensive Anti-Apartheid Act of 1986. This extraordinary history of Michigan's commitment to African independence and African democracy, and we want to hear more of that story this morning. So, Howard Wolpe, how did you become interested in Africa? Where did that? What's the origin of that concern?
Well, I was finishing my college activity at Reed College in 1960, which happened to be the year in which a number of African countries were coming to independence, Nigeria most notably. And I'd long been kind of focused on issues of race and racism, and I was intrigued by the prospect of having blacks at last and the opportunity to be self-governing. A situation we had not yet experienced within the United States. And so it was the anti-colonial struggle for nationalism, nationalist struggles that began to emerge across the continent that really drew my attention to Africa. So that's how I ended up deciding to focus upon Africa in my graduate work.
So you went directly to MIT there to work
Africa? I went to MIT. They had just acquired a few years earlier the National Defense Education Act Fellowships, and I was able to secure one of those. I was debating at the time whether to do law school first or go for my doctorate first, and the fellowship made an easy decision for me. And MIT was developing a whole new specialization in developing areas work, and that's what drew me to that particular institution.
Who did you work most closely with there in that work?
Well, ironically, within MIT itself, there were very few people that knew anything about Africa. Michael Banton was there for one brief period. But most of my African studies coursework was undertaken at Boston University, because if you lived in Cambridge and you could take courses, work at either Harvard, Boston University, or MIT, they had this kind of cooperative program. And so at the Boston University, I remember working with Al Castaño, who was then, I think, the head of the African Studies Center. Ruth Schachter, later Ruth Schachter Morgenthau, was one of my professors there. Jeffrey Butler, Rhodesian, from your own origins, was one of my teachers. I can't recall. I think those were my principal African.
Harold DeWolf was there in history.
Yeah, but I did not take him. I remember meeting at the time a person who's become one of my key friends and resources on the Great Lakes all these last several years, and that was Herbert Weiss, mm-hmm. who was spending some time at Boston University in those mm-hmm. days. My key faculty, advisors that I worked with most closely at MIT were people like Lucian Pai, who was our big China and Burma Asia specialist. I remember when I was doing my doctoral dissertation, he chaired my dissertation committee. Mm-hmm. My principal challenge was trying to persuade Lucian that the Igbos of Eastern Nigeria were not organized in the Chinese warlord model. That was a bit of a struggle. And I had Ethio de Solapool, who was another of my mentors. Mm-hmm. Frederick Fry, a Middle East expert.
Was Willard Johnson there at that time?
Yeah, Willard and I were actually graduate students together at Boston uh-huh. University. We both were in Ruth Schachter Morgenthau's course, mm-hmm. along with David Abernathy, another contemporary.
Mm-hmm. So these are important mentors.
These are the folks that
right.
I worked
and
with.
And they led you in the direction of you're doing your research in Africa?
No. That actually came about by a combination, I think, of two factors. One was the first book I ever read on Africa was James Coleman's book, Nigeria Background on Nationalism, which I still regard as one of the probably classic best books by an American author mm-hmm. on African politics. And the second major influence, I think, was a collaboration I entered into with Richard Sklar, mm-hmm. Who is one of the America's great Africanists and certainly preeminent Nigerian scholars. He was then at Brandeis University. And so I don't remember how I directly linked up to Dick, but we became quite close. And Dick was the man who, I remember, wrote the two letters of introduction that I took with me mm-hmm. to Nigeria that really launched me upon my work in that country.
And so you were there to do dissertation research?
Yeah.
And when did that begin, and what was that focus?
I was in Nigeria from April of 1963 to February of 1965. My original conception was to replicate the work of Robert Dahl, who had done these really quite exciting community power studies, most notably of New Haven, Connecticut. And I wanted that you take his methodology and some of his techniques and apply them to the study of the political development of a new urban community in Nigeria. And I ended up selecting Port Harcourt for that research. And I, in fact, did take his techniques and did do much of the approach to the subject matter, much as he had in New Haven, Connecticut, looking at a historical progression of Port Harcourt and looking at all the different ethnic political configurations that emerged over time and trying to understand how that city put itself together politically over the years, now transformed itself over the years. But as I began to write my dissertation, I think on page 600 of this terribly large volume, I suddenly realized that I really was looking at a different subject, which was really the relationship between economic change and urbanization on the one side and communal identity and communal conflict on the other. And that issue of race, of ethnicity, of the management of communal identities and communal conflict, that became for me the center of both my academic and also subsequently my political activity.
And that's what you've been working on lately
in
Rwanda and Burundi.
Exactly, right? Exactly.
Right. Out of that, you came back and completed the dissertation at MIT. Where did your career take you then?
Well, actually, when I came back, I ended up going to law school at the University of Chicago for 1 year. I actually finished my dissertation while I was in law school, which was one of the most horrendous years of my life. And I spent another third of my activity anti-war organizing in the Seventh Ward of Chicago. And I decided that law school was not for me, despite my original intentions, and started looking around for a teaching job. And I happened to have given a paper on Nigeria and the Nigerian-Biafran War that had broken out. And I had given a paper at the in Northwestern, a conference that had been held there. And there was a professor from Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo, Michigan, that had heard me. And so they were looking for an Africanist. And it was very late in the school year, like April or May, that I began to search for a teaching job. And so when they were looking for an Africanist, I thought I would move to... I accepted the position there at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo with every expectation that I would be there for a single year. I didn't know there really was a Kalamazoo, like the song, no real knowledge of the community or anything about Michigan. And my original plan was to move back to California and seek a position at Berkeley or at Stanford. But things worked out in a way that was quite unanticipated, and I was very grateful for that.
Mm-hmm. So while you were at Western, you had your first political involvement in the Kalamazoo City Council. Is that where that began?
No, my political involvement began earlier. I arrived in Michigan in 67, September 67, and it was in April of 1968 that Dr. Martin Luther King was assassinated. Mm-hmm. And ironically, in terms of the connection to my Africa work and my subsequent political involvement, that evening I was hosting a group of Igbo students from Michigan State University who were performing a program of song and dance, raising money for the Biafran relief effort. Mm. And it fell to me to get up in the middle of the program and announce the word that Dr. King had just been killed. We abandoned the program that evening. But it was Dr. King's assassination that really sort of launched me into local community organizing and political activity. A group of us came together the next morning, a group of us faculty, and when we came to the campus the next morning, we discovered that black students had organized themselves, had taken control of the student center. There was a very angry group of white students that were threatening to physically march into the center and take back what they called their student center. And a group of us faculty organized ourselves as a human cordon just to stay between the students and the building to try to avoid confrontation. And it was basically that initial activity that led to the mobilization in the community of folks from all around, from Kalamazoo College, from Western Michigan University, from the churches, from the civil rights community. And we worked all weekend in organizing ourselves for a march on City Hall on Monday evening. At that point in time, the Kalamazoo City Commission had been taken over by an ultra-conservative group of majority, some of whose members were considered John Birchers, members of the John Birch Society. And there was a good deal of open, overt racism that characterized some of their conduct. The mayor used to speak of riding shotgun with the police on the north side and would speak of blacks as the enemy. And it was a very ugly moment. And so we decided to try to use the emotional energy of Dr. King's assassination to try to organize around the issues of race and poverty. We had, as I say, this very massive march downtown. We had over 5,000 people turn up, and this was unprecedented for sedate Kalamazoo. And I remember helping to craft a document that called a call for a new beginning. That became kind of a rallying cry for a new kind of activism in Kalamazoo. And that led to the creation of an organization called Action Now, which became the community organizing vehicle centered on these issues of race and poverty. And then 2 years later, taking the organization that we built around that, I ended up making the decision to run for city commission in Kalamazoo. And put together a coalition of the black community, of women's organizations at the campus, and organized labor. much to the dismay of the Chamber of Commerce and the establishment elements of the Kalamazoo, they did not want me to run. I was viewed as either a communist or an alien, an outsider, and these are not exactly positive political characteristics. But we threatened to run our own slate that would divide the candidates and allow the ultra-conservatives to retake control of the city commission again. Hmm. So at the end of the day, they agreed to endorse me as part of this broad coalition we put together. And I ended up being elected to the city commission, coming in seventh of the seven candidates that prevailed, 130 votes ahead of the eighth candidate. There were 17,000 votes that cast in that election. And that's how I snuck into my political role.
I see. And you were there in that role for how long?
I was reelected to the city council and doing somewhat better my second time. And then there was a new set of legislative districts that were created. And I happened to accidentally move into what became a district that looked like a Democrat had a fighting chance to get elected to the state legislature. Up to that point in time, there had never been a Democrat elected from Kalamazoo. And so I ran for the state legislature and was elected in November of 1976 and began my work in the legislature in 1977 through 1980. It was 1972 to 76, then 73 to 76 that I was actually in the legislature.
Right. And in that case, you left your position at Western.
It was a full-time legislature. I initially took a leave of absence, but converted that into a permanent departure. Yeah.
Position. Were there Africa components at all in the work in the state legislature at that point?
No, there were not. In fact, I really thought that it would be unlikely that I would be returning to my Africa involvement in any major fashion, because it just didn't seem to be the direction of my political activity. Mm-hmm. And so it was really quite a thrill when things changed and went in a very different direction subsequently. In those days, to the extent there was foreign policy involvement, it was much more centered on the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm. Right. Before we leave Nigeria, you were leaving Nigeria having completed your research about the time the Biafran War is breaking out and Nigeria.
Before the war broke out, I had left Nigeria, but a lot of the prelude of the war was being clearly manifest.
Right, and so that kind of ethnic and political dynamic was that led to the war was also part of your concern all these years as well.
I was in Nigeria during a wonderful moment. There was still the sense of the post-independence kind of euphoria. You had a very robust political debate. You had all the diversity, but people seemed quite comfortable with diversity. It felt very much like being within an American kind of political context, and there was no sense that ethnicity was about to become a major point of danger to the national political system. And so it was a very exciting moment. There was one situation that emerged in 64, I think it was around November of 64, when there was a general strike in the country for 2 weeks. And it was fascinating because though ethnicity had always been a major theme of Nigerian political life, it was much as in the United States, and it didn't, as I say, it wasn't particularly threatening of the political fabric. And then during the two-week general strike, for a moment, all the ethnic identities were suddenly had vanished, and people had organized themselves around their occupational and economic and class roles, and a lot of folks... inaccurately, we're beginning to talk about an end to ethnicity as a point of distinction in Nigeria. I thought that was unrealistic at the time, and in fact, part of my writing later was to try to understand the ethnicity in a different way, and that it was not inconsistent with people at certain moments in time organizing themselves on different bases. But it was a time when you didn't have a real sense of what subsequently developed. And in fact, you know, what happened, it was the military in Nigeria that really destroyed this country, that they were not good managers of the political, of all the various political strains within the country. And it was a classic case of of ethnicity not causing the conflict, but of very bad governance causing the conflict and leading to the temptation, growing temptation of political figures to manipulate ethnicity mm-hmm. for their own self-serving political purposes.
Mm-hmm. So do you view then the Biafran Declaration of Independence then as part of, because in some ways that gave the military the excuse to assume power in many ways in Nigeria?
Yeah, well, I was, because of some of what had happened, this was after I had left Nigeria, but you had this terrible pogrom directed against Igbos in the northern part of the country, and it was just a very, very traumatic moment. And I partly probably because of my work with Igbos for so many years, I was quite felt a lot of empathy and sympathy for the Biafran cause at that moment in time because of what had happened to in the communal massacres that had occurred. And so that led me to become involved, I remember, in the Biafran relief effort. A strange coalition mm-hmm. came together. Stephen Lewis mm-hmm. in Canada, who now is Kofi Annan, who is one of Canada's great ambassadors to the United Nations, the premier Africanist from Canada, who today is Kofi Annan's special representative on AIDS in Africa. Mm-hmm. Fulton Lewis Jr. III and I ended up organizing the national Biafran relief effort. But it came out of that kind of history that led us to that involvement.
Very similar to Michigan State's deep involvement with the building of the University of Nigeria at Nsukka,
mm-hmm.
and similar kinds of sympathies, I think. So you look back at that period and with some sadness of what followed afterwards with the military.
Oh, yes. Yes. I mean, I've often spoken of Nigeria as being my second home. Mm-hmm. And I just, two of my most wonderful years were spent in that country. I returned to Nigeria for the first time about 18 years later, 1981, as chairman of the Africa Subcommittee. And I went to, there were a couple of cute stories to share mm-hmm. about that trip back. I was among my colleagues who was with me in the congressional delegation was Congressman George Crockett, also from Michigan. And we become good friends, and he was the ranking member of the committee that I was then chairing. And I remember going to visit the two leading political advisors to the prime minister at the time, Abubakar, and there were two Igbos. And when we went into this meeting with these guys, I had not met them before. But they knew of my work, my writing on Igbo politics, and my book on Lord Harcourt, and I was received so warmly. I was embraced, and we immediately got into a very open and candid discussion about what was then going on in Nigeria, about the corruption, about who was stabbing whom in the back. It was a very candid discussion, the kind of conversation that Nigerians would have with each other. Well, I remember walking out of that office, and George turned to me. It was the only time I think he was ever really upset with me. He thought that my behavior was totally reprehensible, inappropriate. How could I engage in that kind of conversation as a foreign visitor with our Nigerian hosts? And it was subsequently later when he began to realize that I had a somewhat deeper
history
in Nigeria that made that a more permissible mm-hmm. activity. The second moment for me on that trip was to go to Port Harcourt, where, returning to Port Harcourt, I was received by a large, large delegation at the airport. I was received like a lost returning son. There's a dinner that was organized for me in my honor at the University of Port Harcourt that had since been established. But the irony was, there was not a single Igbo there. When I did my book on Port Harcourt and my research, 85% of the community was Igbo speaking, and 15% was Ija, Bibio, Efik from the rivers area. And now it had become a river state, and all the Igbos at that point had been forced out, and there was a strange kind of juxtaposition. All my Ija and Ibibio Efik friends came down to meet with me, and it was wonderful, but it seemed a little bit strange. And then I remember going back to our house that we had lived in on I.B. Johnson Street, right in the center of town, and down the street, I lived a few doors away from Graham Douglas, who had become a Minister of Justice, or Attorney General, I forget which, of Nigeria. Wonderful man. And his house had been razed in the war, and he saw the evidence of the war even in the block in which we had lived.
Mm. So with the turning to the state legislature, you had to put your Africa focus and your teaching behind you for a while. How long were you in the state legislature?
4 years.
For 4 years.
4 years.
Right. And are there particular foci of your work there in the
state? Oh, there were. And as I said earlier, nothing about Africa. There, right. my major activities were in the areas of mental health and prison reform. And then one of the more public activities of mine, I was appointed to lead a special committee that was appointed to investigate the Public Service Commission in the whole area of utility regulation. Mm-hmm. And it turned out to be quite a successful investigation where we identified a lot of bad things going on. We got money rebated to the ratepayers of Consumers Power Company and others, and I think that's what basically created the basis upon which I was able to build a bipartisan constituency for my subsequent run for the Congress. Mm-hmm. But it was areas, but those were my areas. And I did some work, well, general work in environmental areas as well when I was in the state legislature.
Mm-hmm. So that was good preparation for the run for the Congress then, just in the Michigan issues.
Yeah, it was. And because my district was totally, it had been a Republican area. And, of course, the 3rd Congressional District, which is my congressional district, was, when I first ran for Congress, was 57% baseline Republican. And so the only hope I had of ever prevailing in that congressional district was to build a support that transcended the partisan divisions. I mean, I had good support from organized labor, from the black community, from the campuses. But I had to go beyond that, and the kinds of issues in which I became engaged in Congress, mental health, public health, political campaign finance reform, the environment, utility regulation, were the kinds of issues that really do cut across all of the party divisions, and I think provided the basis upon which I could begin to organize. The other thing we did that was quite unusual, I mean, in fact, it was the first such venture in Michigan. When I ran for the state legislature, I advertised as my only commitment that I would organize a local legislative service office and which would function as a community ombudsman and as a means of mobilizing much deeper public participation in political life. It was actually another Africanist by the name of Dick Simpson, who was a specialist in Sierra Leone, who I had met in my days of going to African Studies Association meetings. He had become an independent alderman in Chicago. He had beat the Daily Machine in Chicago. And using a number of very innovative techniques of political mobilization, and he had actually ended up writing a couple of books on that experience. And I borrowed a lot of his lessons in conceptualizing how I would approach electoral politics in Michigan. And so when I was elected, I opened up this 46 district service office. There were no public funds. We had to raise the money privately to support the staff, to support the office itself. Mm-hmm. We ended up, and the office became established as a community ombudsman. So we began to have Democrats, Republicans, independents, not only from my district, from all around the region, using my office as their as their advocate in dealing with the federal government, the state government, the local government. We also began to use it to create citizen task forces organized around issues that I was involved with in Lansing. We had a mental health task force that helped advise me on the mental health code that we were then in the process of revising. We had a task force on environment that worked with me on returnable bottle legislation. A lot of different issues. And that became sort of my political, I think, identity was one of kind of a populist, community-based organizer. And that's how I think began to deepen my broader base that really did reach beyond normal traditional Democrats.
And that worked in the in your run for the election?
Yeah, exactly.
What was the timing of that? And how did
I first ran for Congress in 1976. And I was running against a six-term Republican incumbent, Gary Brown. No one thought I had a chance at winning, so we had a tremendous difficulty raising funds. And it turned out that I led on election night. I led all night, and then at 7 o'clock in the morning, the numbers started to shift, and I ended up losing the election. Mm-hmm. I had 49.7% of the vote. Mm-hmm. I still remember, as some of these things stay in your mind, that I lost my 3,970 votes out of 200,000 that were cast. But that really made clear that this was a district that, in fact, was winnable. Mm-hmm. And subsequently, Senator Donald Regal was elected to the United States Senate. And he then asked me to open his office in Lansing to serve as his surrogate in that part of the state, and including my old congressional district. Right. And so I was able to remain visible and active, helping to service local governments and help solve problems for people for about 15 months, when I then declared my candidacy once again for election to the Congress. And the second time, we were successful.
By a significant...
In 1978.
By a significant majority?
Mm-hmm. Oh, no, never in my district by a significant majority. I think I won by 50.2% the first time I was elected.
Kind of John Kennedy margin.
I had one year, I think, my biggest margin. I think one time I got up to 55, 56 maybe. But normally my margins were 50, 51, 52%.
So you had to stay actively campaigning and actively engaged with the district.
Yeah, in fact, every time I ran for office in Congress, both the one I lost and then subsequently, I was always in the top 20 races targeted by Republicans for defeat, because their perception was here, this was a rock-ribbed Republican district, and I had one of the most liberal voting records in Congress, and it just seemed to them to be outrageous that I could continue to be reelected in that district.
Right.
So every 2 years, I had to raise approximately $800,000, which in those days, today, that would be $1.5 million you'd have to be raising to maintain solvency, to maintain the possibility of being competitive.
Did Africa play a role at all in any of those campaigns? Was it ever brought up by constituents that you're not really focused on American problems? You've got this foreign affairs...
Seldom by constituents, but always by my opponents. In fact, in my second or third campaign, one of my opponents came up with the motto or the slogan that Wolpe cares more about the third world than the third district. And I desperately wished I had a different district number, because it was a great slogan. Yeah, that was a major theme of almost all my opponents. And because of that, when I was in Congress, a lot of my own political energy was, and a lot of the more high-profile activity in which I engaged, centered on domestic issues. I chaired the Energy and Environmental Study Conference for a long period of time. I chaired the Northeast Midwest Congressional Coalitions, I think, for 6 or 8 years, for an extended period of time. That was a bipartisan caucus that advocated for Michigan and other states in our region.
The Great Lakes Commission as well.
There was no Great Lakes Commission, but we were involved with Great Lakes water issues all the time. Mm-hmm. And I also began to I lost my train. There was another activity I was engaged in Congress. Everything that we could do to try to maintain the focus on as myself being an advocate for Michigan and for the region.
Right. So you arrive in Congress, and when does Africa appear on your agenda in Washington?
Well, when I got to Congress, I remember getting all sorts of advice from almost everyone but one person that I should not go into the Foreign Affairs Committee, that the district was such a difficult political district for a Democrat to hold on to, that there was no gain to be... from being on the Foreign Affairs Committee. You were always killed because you had to vote for foreign assistance if you were a member of the committee, and I was given all sorts of advice to stay away from it. But it was Congressman Bill Broadhead who said to me, Howard, when you're up here, you may as well use the time in ways that you are satisfying to you, that you enjoy, and where you think you can make a difference. That ought to be your first criterion. So I figured that, given my African expertise, that was the one place where perhaps I could make a contribution more quickly than in other areas. The funny thing was, so we decided that I would seek a position on the Foreign Affairs Committee, and that my second committee assignment would be the House Science, Space, and Technology Committee, which was very involved in environmental issues and energy policy, and that was of interest to my constituents, and so that would give me my domestic cover, in a sense. Well, I didn't even lobby for the Foreign Affairs Committee, because no one in those days ever wanted to be in Foreign Affairs Committee, so I spent all my effort lobbying for my second committee assignment, thinking that it was going to be a slam dunk to get my House Foreign Affairs Committee assignment. It turned out that because people who were denied their first preferences had chosen, who were more senior than I, had chosen the Foreign Affairs Committee for their second choice. And so at the end, they filled out the committee without me on it. Mm-hmm. But then the leadership made a decision to literally expand the size of the committee to make sure that I could get on the Foreign Affairs, because they recognized that was my real expertise. Hmm. So the committee was expanded that year to allow me to be on the committee. And I also got my science, space, and technology assignment that I had sought.
So were you seen as the committee's Africa foreign policy expert?
Well, they knew that I was an Africanist, and that part was recognized. But at the time I got on the committee, Steve Solars had just become committee chairman. The term before that, Charlie Diggs had been chairman of the subcommittee. And then Steve had now taken it over. So I was simply, at that point, a member of the subcommittee with no expectations that I would... You know, usually it takes 3, 4, 5 terms for a member of Congress to acquire enough seniority to become eligible for a chairmanship of a subcommittee. But then a number of events happened that suddenly made this a possibility in my second term.
Mm-hmm. And was Solar's involvement with Latin America, was that...
Well, what happened was Steve decided that he wanted to move on to another area, and he moved over to initially, was it Latin America or was it Asia? I think he moved over to the Asia subcommittee. Mm-hmm. And what happened was, that was the year, my second term, when I was elected, Ronald Reagan was elected, and the Republicans took over control of the Senate, and Jesse Helms took over the chairmanship of the Senate Foreign Affairs Relations Committee. Well, a number of activists on Latin America and a number of activists on Africa became deeply concerned about what would happen with respect to both Latin American and African policy with Reagan in the White House and Jesse Helms in control of events in the Senate. And so I still recall Toby Moffat, who was a congressman from Connecticut, a real very activist, progressive Democrat, had gone off to attend a meeting of the African American Institute that took place in Africa. I think it was in Senegal that year. And he returned saying that he had discussed the situation with activists and academics who were at this meeting, and there was a strong feeling that it was important that I and Mike Barnes, who was a colleague of mine, we were in the same class, that we both challenged the seniority system in the Foreign Affairs Committee. Mike spoke Spanish, was conversant with Latin America. The man who had been chairman of the Latin American subcommittee in the House side had not been very active at all. I don't think he had done a hearing in a couple of years. And then the person who was in line to become chairman of the Africa subcommittee was from Florida, in my same class, but he had seniority by luck of the draw. And coming from Florida, he had a lot of Cubans to contend with. And so you had both Latin American activists who were deeply concerned about the prospect about the need to have some forum for progressive alternatives to what was going to come out of the Reagan White House or the Jesse Helms Senate Foreign Affairs Committee. And so they came to both of us and pleaded with us that we take the risk of challenging seniority. That had never happened before in the Foreign Affairs Committee, the Foreign Relations Committee, and we were just very reluctant to do so. But Mike and I began to have some conversations with more senior members of the subcommittee and discovered that a number of them were prepared to support us. Hmm. And so we decided to go for it. We lined up our votes. We both spoke to the two people. I remember it was Dan Micah, from Florida, from Gus Yatron, from Pennsylvania, who were in line for these chairmanships. And we went to them and asked them if they would consider stepping down and not challenging for these chairmanships, because we did not want to embarrass them, because we knew we had the votes. The way the system worked, you go into a secret ballot in your committee, in your caucus, and in order of seniority, people would be asked to vote on the choices for the chairs. But they refused to step down, and so the committee passed them over and then chose Mike Barnes and chose me to become the Africa Subcommittee Chair and Mike the Latin Subcommittee Chair. And that's how we got our chairmanships. But the key, the reason that we succeeded politically, turned out to be the Speaker O'Neill had a daughter who was a Catholic nun who had deep involvement in Latin America. And she went to the Speaker, to Tip, and she pleaded with him to stay out of this battle in the Foreign Affairs Committee because of her interest in Latin America. Mm-hmm. So Tip did not get very involved, made a few perfunctory phone calls at the very end after we had already locked up our votes, and we were able to get to our chairmanships.
Right. You came in after Solars, but for a longer period, Charles Diggs, as founder of the Black Caucus in the Congress, had the committee. And many years after, the Congressional Black Caucus has sort of been the source of the chairs since you left. What was your relationship with the Congressional Black Caucus during those years on the in the House Africa Committee?
It was very, very solid. I knew Charlie Diggs well. One of the most awkward moments for me, my very first term of Congress, was the vote that took place on whether or not he should be expelled or censured. Yeah. And I remember Jim Wright rallied most of the members of Congress on both sides of the aisle to vote against his expulsion until the legal process had run its course. But that was very unpopular back in most parts of Michigan. Right. And it was just a very awkward moment, as you can imagine.
Right.
But then I also have very excellent relationships established. Bill Gray and I became very close allies, mm-hmm. political allies. Ron Dellums, George Crockett, John Conyers. We all really worked closely together. And then at some point down there, a few years later, after I'd already become chairman and there was a conceivable that an African-American could become chairman, there was absolutely the Black Caucus stayed really supported my retention of the chairmanship. There was no, mm-hmm. It was really quite nice, and we worked very closely together, and particularly on all the issues related to liberation struggles that were underway in Southern Africa.
Now, you were there as chair at the kind of peak of the Cold War politics in Africa, as well as the, I guess the Portuguese regime had collapsed by the time you were there, but still South Africa and Rhodesia was in the process of changing,
right.
And Namibia was a problem, and with civil war in Angola and to some extent in Mozambique. How did you deal with all of these diverse tensions and issues in Africa at that time?
The first big issue really was Rhodesia, because that was in the last 2 years of the Carter administration. There was this move by the Republicans to lift sanctions that had been imposed upon Rhodesia, and Solars was chairing the committee. And I still remember the day that all of the members of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, at least of our Africa subcommittee, and all the members of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee were called over to the White House suddenly to meet with the president. And we walked into this Oval Office, and Jimmy Carter and Brzezinski were there, and Cy Vance, and we all were sitting on this table, and Jesse Helms and Ted Kennedy and Javits, I mean, all the senators. And Carter announces that he wanted to inform all of us that he had made the decision that he wanted the sanctions to remain on Rhodesia, and because it was the right thing to do. And there was no argument in terms of national interest or in terms of American interest. It was much more of a moral kind of case he was presenting. And he had to love the guy for that, but it would have been nice that he also pointed out that what was moral also happened to be consistent with American national interest. And then I still remember Jesse Helms and turning to the president and saying, "Mr. President, I mean, Bishop Mozarewa, who's a good Christian gentleman, he's going to be coming to America shortly, and it'd be wonderful if you were to sit down and talk with Bishop Mozarewa." And there was this kind of really strange kind of exchange between the president and Jesse Helms and the presence of all the rest of us. And we all went around the table. And I remember that no one thought it was going to be possible to sustain the president's decision to hold sanctions on. But we all, we Democrats at least, and Solars and I and others, said, well, we're going to do our best. But we all were, but there was not a lot of optimism that we could actually prevail. And so the first big fight we had, when I was a member of the committee, not chairman, under Steve was the Solars was the chairman, was the fight to retain sanctions in South Africa. Another kind of ironic moment occurred. George McGovern, who was trying to help us on this issue of sustaining sanctions, had a different approach, and he had been negotiating with Jesse Helms over in the Senate, and thought he had come up with some kind of compromise, which Steve and I thought was a terrible idea. And another of my more awkward moments, my very first term as Congress, was to have George McGovern come over to the House to testify to the House Africa Subcommittee on this idea that he and Jesse Helms had cooked up in the Senate. And it fell, Steve and I had this unhappy responsibility of basically challenging George McGovern, who'd been one of my heroes and who I campaigned for when he ran for the presidency. It was really a very awkward moment. But the good news came later when we, in fact, prevailed. We were able to have the votes to sustain the president's decision to retain sanctions on Rhodesia.
Mm-hmm. What were the other issues? You had some visits to Congo and encounters with Mr. Mobutu.
Oh, later on. When I became chairman of the Africa Subcommittee, of course, the major focus then shifted to, there were three or four major areas of activity, four that I can think of. A very large part of our activity, of course, centered on, as you suggested, the anti-apartheid struggle, on the Namibia struggle, and some very interesting involvement there as well, on trying to resist Ronald Reagan's efforts to lift the Clark Amendment and permit covert assistance to flow to Jonas Savimbi and UNITA in Angola, and then on trying to disassociate. A good part of my effort, and Steve Solars as well, was centered on trying to break our ties with Mobutu and this perception that we were a big bulwark of Mobutu's strength in Zaire. And then we became later involved also in taking on Moi and the human rights deterioration in Kenya. And then finally, the last area of major involvement was around the issues of famine and hunger. We actually wrote the African Development Fund legislation that established Africa as a separate entity for purposes of development assistance, and we were able to substantially increase the development aid flows to the continent. Those are my major areas of activity, and there were fascinating anecdotes and stories, I think, that attached to each one of those stories.
I think back in Michigan, you're known for your association with the Comprehensive Anti-Apartheid Act of 86. Was that a tough thing to achieve against the presidential veto?
It was a major struggle. There were a number of different elements of it that were difficult for me personally. I had a Kellogg company and the Upjohn Drug Company were my two largest corporate entities. They were both in my congressional district, and so I had this kind of running encounter group for all the years I was in Congress, because I actually supported the total disinvestment from South Africa, which was not exactly what they wanted to hear. And there were a lot of moments that were quite tense and difficult around that issue, both domestically and politically for me. But then in the Congress, of course, we had this uphill battle. We had Ronald Reagan and the new policy of so-called constructive engagement, which, in my view, was doing nothing but reinforcing the Afrikaners and everything that they wanted to hear, and was not being helpful in moving the liberation process forward. We had in the Congress, though, what began to happen was very interesting, because a number of Republicans became increasingly anxious about the image that they themselves, the Republican Party, because of Reagan's position, appeared to be supportive of the Afrikaner white minority regime. And a number of Republicans were not comfortable in being put in that position. And so we began to develop on an informal basis initially, even with some bizarre bedfellows, people like Newt Gingrich and Bob Walker and others, a dialogue that began to lay the basis for a bipartisan approach on sanctions. Now, even then, there was no one on the Republican side that was willing to support the position that was articulated in Ron Dellums' legislation of total disinvestment. But at least they were willing to talk about sanctions of various dimensions. And so we began to work together on developing this legislation. We did a modest effort initially, and then subsequently the comprehensive anti-apartheid legislation passed, which was the more broader set of sanctions. One of the stories that's not told, not very well known, is that another Michigan congressman played a role in its passage unintentionally. My former student was Mark Siljander. Mm-hmm. I taught him at West Michigan University, and Mark had never quite forgiven me for a C that I gave him in his coursework. Had declared to the world that he was going to follow me to the ends of the earth, and ended up actually getting himself elected to the state legislature, and then elected to the Congress, and he came on the Foreign Affairs Committee, then on the Africa Subcommittee, and became my principal nemesis for most of my years I was chairing the Africa Subcommittee. I remember one time we had this huge debate, I think it was on Southern African policy, and a public hearing, and at one stage, he turned to me and said, in front of everyone, said, "Howard, you know, everything I learned about Africa, I learned from you." To which I responded, "Mark, it was at that moment that I realized that teaching was not my mission." But the day that we were debating on the House floor, the Comprehensive Anti-Apartheid Act, Mark was managing the floor for the Republicans, the opposition to the legislation for the Republicans. And we had a strategy that we had in mind, where we had the base bill, which provided some very comprehensive sanctions, but not total disinvestment. And then we were going to have Ron Dellums offer his amendment for total disinvestment, and that would then be voted on the House floor, which would allow a lot of moderate Democrats and Republicans to vote no, so they could show that they voted against a really extreme measure and then would be more comfortable in voting for the more modest sanctions bill. Well, what happened was Mark who was managing the floor for the Republicans, forgot to ask for a roll call vote. And so the Dellums Amendment passed. And so the House version of the legislation had this total disinvestment, which greatly strengthened the House position when we entered into the conference committee with the Senate. Senator Lugar was then chairing the Senate committee, and Nancy Kassenbaum was in the Senate subcommittee, Africa chair. And we all worked very well together then in fashioning a very strong, comprehensive anti-apartheid act. But it happened partly by way of a fluke.
Fascinating. During that same period, we estimate that the South Africans were spending perhaps close to $1 million a year in Michigan to influence policy here, with trips for Michigan legislators and mayors and company officials, as well as instructional materials in the schools in Michigan about how the Happy Bantu were being taken care of by their white benefactors. Mm-hmm. Do you think that effort was so strong here in Michigan by the South Africans because they wanted to get at you and get it at the constituents here?
I think there was some of that, because we know that, aside from what you've just described, we know that South Africans and Namibians had a very direct campaign centered on me. There was an organization, the name of which I forget, that was advocating for the conservative Afrikaner position on Namibia. And they actually issued press releases and public attacks that were targeted in my congressional district and other my radio stations, and media received these kinds of epistles from time to time. And then on one occasion, Western Michigan University suddenly had a visitor, an Afrikaner who had described himself as a professor, who asked if he might use the facilities of the university for some months to undertake some research. And the Western Michigan University's Department of Political Science welcomed him there. They thought it would be a good opportunity to have someone from South Africa present and begin to do some dialogue mm-hmm. with students on these issues. So he was there, and about 2 weeks after he had arrived, as I recall, he suddenly authored a Sunday Kalamazoo Gazette op-ed that was a vicious attack on me. claiming that Wolpe was inside South Africa, intervening in their internal affairs, was supporting the communists. It was so strident that it was humorous. It was so strident, so extreme. And the very next day, he was gone. The university never saw or heard from him again.
Accomplished his mission.
Yeah, he clearly had been sent there by the South African intelligence services to do this number. So there was some activity that was very much directed at me.
But at that time, the Michigan opinion was strong, given that legislature had passed.
Yeah, I never became, aside from my relationships with my two corporate constituents, in general terms, it never really became a problem for me with my constituency. And I think that, in fact, when I had these kind of really extreme radical attacks, it almost helped me. I mean, I also then, was attacked by Prime Minister Botha. At one point, I was declared persona non grata. I went into South Africa in 1981 the first time, and that was a fascinating moment. It was my first trip to South Africa. It was in 1981. I had a 7-person congressional delegation that included George Crockett and several others, and Shirley Chisholm was a member of my delegation, and it was her first time outside of the United States since she had come from the Caribbean area, and she never traveled to Africa before. And it was, I think, we spent 4 days in South Africa, 17 days on that continent, but 4 days in South Africa, and it was without a doubt one of the most moving emotional experiences for all of us that we had ever had in our lifetimes. There were several encounters that we had there that were so poignant. I remember one stage of going in to see Dr. Matlana at his home in Soweto. This was the man who had become identified with resistance within Soweto, who was became Mandela's personal physician subsequently. Was a legendary figure inside South Africa. And he was with patients when we arrived, and we all went into his little living room, and then eventually he turned up and went around shaking hands with each of us. And when he and Shirley Chisholm encountered each other, there was this moment when neither said a word. They just embraced each other. They both have this kind of symbolic import to each other, to one another. It was just, and there was not a dry eye in the group. And I remember trying to leave the discussion and having difficulties. It was just extraordinary. And there were other moments like that. Shirley Chisholm at one point called me over when she's in the bus, to just tears rolling down her face, to thank me for getting her into South Africa, for seeing what she had seen. And we had extraordinary experiences staying overnight in homes in Soweto one evening, followed the subsequent evening by staying at the home of an Afrikaner, a dean of an Afrikaner business school. And the contrast between the kind of the deprivation and the degradation that was occurring in the townships versus the kind of lifestyle that was a very small number of people in South Africa was experiencing in the white Afrikaner community. It was just so staggering. The last day of our trip, as we were departing, we had learned that there was a group of people that had begun to squatters that had outside of the crossroads and in a meadow, and that the South African police had been trying to starve them into forcing them to return to their homes from the homelands. And it had put a police cordon around them and had torn down their huts that they had established, and the rain was coming down, and they were a pretty bedraggled group. And so we decided, the media were following us everywhere on this particular trip, that on the way back to the airport we would come by this encampment of these squatters and to draw attention to what was happening. And we were able to get in. We had a white Anglican minister came and met us and showed us a back way into this meadow, and it was an incredible sight to behold. Well, after that, we went directly from that to the airport, where I did an exit press conference, and I had stayed up the night before writing a statement on behalf of my delegation, which I proceeded to read, and then I turn the microphone over to Shirley Chisholm and to Berkeley Bedell from Iowa, white member of Congress from Iowa. And the two of them broke down in tears, mm-hmm. trying to capture what they had experienced in those days we were there. And then we were walking out to the airplane, and we had, at the time, a chargé by the name of... His first name was Howard. I'm blocking it now on his last name, but the same first name as my own. And Howard Walker. And he was African-American, though he was very fair, and many people did not even realize that he was African-American. And he was one of these Foreign Service officers that was terribly reserved. He would never display emotion, always formally correct. Well, as we're walking out to the airplane, he leans over to me. It's funny, I still have the difficulty of recounting this. Mm-hmm. And just said that he had never felt prouder to be an American mm-hmm. than that at that moment. Mm-hmm. Referring to the press conference mm-hmm. that we had just mm-hmm. gone through. Mm-hmm. So it was really an extraordinary kind of, that was really an extraordinary moment for all of us.
And as a key, crucible moment for the beginnings of stronger change in U.S. policy.
Yeah, it really was.
So that during that period, what were your relationships with the State Department and with the Assistant Secretary of State for Africa, which I guess was Chester Crocker, during most of that period? Right?
And then later on, Hank Cohn.
Right.
Difficult, especially with Crocker. Relationships were difficult. We've since become much more friendly to one another and actually work together in some things now. But there were very difficult moments because I was so upset with some of what the administration was trying to do in those days. There was one moment, though, that there were a number of things that were happening that at times we would find moments to collaborate. For example, there on the issue of UNITA and Angola, I believe personally that Crocker privately never was comfortable with the repeal of the Clark Amendment. I think he was being a good soldier and didn't want to alienate the conservatives.
And the Clark Amendment had kept the U.S. From supporting
the Clark Amendment,
Savimbi and the original internal war.
And then Reagan organized this effort to, and successfully did not succeed in blocking the effort to repeal. So it was repealed. We began to give all of this covert assistance to Jonas Savimbi and UNITA. And when that began, when that support began, the Angolans pulled out of negotiations over the question of Namibia and independence. And the South Africans, the Angolans, and were all involved in this dialogue about Namibian independence negotiations. Well, at some point, some American flyer had been captured by the Angolans, mm-hmm. and Congressman Jack Murtha from Pennsylvania was approached by this man's parents, that asking Murtha to come to me. They had heard that I had a good relationship with Dos Santos and the Angolans, and asked if I would try to negotiate the release of this flyer from the Angolans. And this was one time when I thought that Chet Crocker's and my interests were the same. We both wanted to see a resumption of the diplomacy and negotiations over Namibian independence. I wanted to see if I could use this opportunity to persuade Jack Murtha, who had always voted against me and who was a very conservative Democrat who had usually voted with the Republicans, to see develop a different perspective on Angola and on Southern Africa. And so he agreed to fly with me to Angola. We worked out the negotiations. The Angolans were delighted to release this man, but they wanted to do so in a way that would demonstrate their desire for a better diplomatic relationship with the United States. And so Crocker and I worked together. Crocker helped get an airplane. We had a State Department person go with us, and a New York Times reporter as well. And we went into Angola, and in fact, that became a moment when Dos Santos met with me and with Mickey Leland privately and asked for our advice, and we urged that he resume diplomacy and resume the negotiations, and subsequently thereafter that happened.
So there were points of cooperation as well,
yeah,
as the conflict on the basic policy.
Exactly.
That's right. After all this focus on Nigeria originally in your scholarly work, and then on Southern Africa heavily in the House Committee, since you left the Congress, you've had a heavy focus on a different part of Africa.
Yes.
How has that emerged?
Well, when I came to Michigan and ran unsuccessfully for governor in '94, I went over to Tony Lake of the who was then the National Security Advisor, asked me if it were possible for me to get established at Brookings Institution or some similar think tank, so that if there were projects that emerged where my history as an Africanist and the relationships that I had built over time as chairman of the Africa Subcommittee could be put to work on behalf of the administration. And that's exactly what happened. 10 months after I moved over to Brookings, I had a grant from the Carnegie Corporation. I was doing some work in Southern Africa. And I received a phone call asking if I would consider becoming a presidential special envoy initially to the Burundi peace process. In 1994, you'd had this terrible genocide in Rwanda, in which up to 800,000 or more people were slaughtered. There was a desperate concern that Burundi not go the way of Rwanda, and there was a desire to do everything we could to try to help prevent that from happening. And so I agreed to become special envoy to the Burundi peace process, working with Julius Nyerere, who was then the former president of Tanzania. One of the reasons they wanted me was I had a history of some relationship with Nyerere, and I was known by so many of the leaders, and I worked with them as Africa subcommittee chair earlier, with Mugabe, with Sam Nyoma, and in Namibia, with Mbeki, with Mandela, and so on. And so and then a year later, my appointment was expanded to be special envoy to Africa's Great Lakes region, because the Congo War and the Burundi War involved many of the same actors, either as belligerent parties or as facilitators within the region. And so for about five years, I served as presidential special envoy in that region.
And you continue that work today?
I do. When I left the administration, when the Bush administration took over, I moved over to the Woodrow Wilson International Center. I had a grant from the Institute for Peace to begin a book on the lessons learned from the Burundi peace process. But now I've become director of the Africa program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center. And I became a consultant as well to the World Bank. I proposed to the bank an idea that I had actually proposed to Nyerere many years earlier, which he did not find attractive at the time, which was, given the trauma of this traumatized nature of the Burundian society, there had been so much death and violence, maybe 400,000 people killed, 600,000 refugees, that in order to effectively to ensure that any of these agreements that they've been negotiating, and to ensure that economic reconstruction would be possible, to ensure that any of that, make all of that sustainable, it was necessary to deepen the ability of Burundian leaders to work together collaboratively, because they were so fearful and suspicious of one another. Well, as I say, Nyerere didn't like the idea. I think he feared that kind of training and negotiating skills and communications and collaborative decision-making that I was proposing would somehow interfere with his control of the negotiations process. So we couldn't do it then. But the World Bank recognized the value of this kind of proposal. So they provided a substantial sum of money to the Woodrow Wilson International Center. And I've been working there for the last 2 years, about a year now, on this program, where we are identifying 100 leaders very strategically from every element of the society. Half are come from the political class, meaning the political parties, the army, all of the rebel groups. Half come from civil society, meaning the churches, the women's organizations, academia, media, the business community. And and we're providing training in using interactive techniques, simulations, role-playing, on the various issues that get in the way of collaborative decision-making. That process has become so successful that the Army leadership and the Rebel leadership asked if we could provide the same training for their Army and Rebel military commanders to set the stage for the implementation of the ceasefire agreement and for the integration of the Army. And so we just finished a training in Nairobi a few weeks ago where we had 17 Army commanders, 20 Rebel commanders, and that was so successful that now the Chief of Staff of the Army and the World Bank are asking us to develop a whole program for a year-long program for the Military Integrated Command and for the Ceasefire Commission. The techniques we are using have had such impact and the process has been so powerful that now the bank, the United Nations, and others are beginning to look at this as, in terms of the possible application of these kinds of techniques to other countries and other conflict zones. So I'm very excited. This has been a very extraordinary experience for me.
Howard Wolpe, after 4 decades of involvement with Africa in a variety of roles as a scholar, an analyst, now as a peace negotiator, and through American congressional eyes, how do you end up feeling about Africa in big terms and its future in this period of which development has seen lost for major portions of the continent?
Well, I remain an optimist because I see so many good things happening in Africa, notwithstanding the enormity of some of the challenges. It's important to keep in mind that by the late 90s, two-thirds of the continent was making significant progress, both economically in terms of market reforms, in terms of economic policy and transparency, and also politically in terms of democratization. They were making good progress. And then two things happened dramatically set back the continent. One was the explosion of the HIV/AIDS pandemic. And the second was the explosion of certain conflicts that have had broad reach. So the two principal challenges are to getting the AIDS pandemic under control and resolving some of these larger conflicts that exploded in Congo and Sudan and elsewhere. But on the second front, we're beginning to see some significant strides toward bringing these conflicts under control and beginning to work through some new reconciliation in a number of these conflict-plagued parts of the continent. And I know that we can make a huge difference in dealing with the AIDS pandemic, but that has to be the international focus, and it has been so sad and so frustrating to see the tardiness of our response to that. Now we're finally beginning to see the kind of mobilization that should have begun 10 years ago. But I believe that if we can begin to get those two issues under control and the situations of Uganda and Senegal demonstrate that it is possible to turn back this terrible pandemic and to reverse the incidence of disease, then I think that the potential for Africa is very, very positive.
Historical footnote, how did you decide to spend the summer at MSU and to publish your book with the MSU Press?
Well, a colleague of mine, Robert Melson, who became a co-author of the Nigeria volume, was then teaching at Michigan State University. I was teaching at Western. And then Carl Eicher and Carl Liedholm, also at Michigan State, were very deeply involved as agricultural development experts working in Africa, in Nigeria. And a colloquium was organized here at Michigan State University, and the four of us led the colloquium, and then we produced two books, one focused on economics, one focused on the politics of Nigeria, spending a summer in East Lansing.
Well, Howard Wolpe of Michigan, thank you very much.
Thank you.